notice of board meetings in writing, please email Monica at kbu.org.
Andy Warhol looks at screen. Hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen. Can't tell them apart at all.
My name's Joseph Gallivan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Rick Axum, Senior Curator of the Madison Museum of Contemporary Art in Madison, Wisconsin. He's here to talk about Andy Warhol prints from the collection of Jordan D. Schnitzer and his family foundation. Thanks for coming into KBOO.
Thank you.
The show, Andy Warhol Prints, was curated by Sarah Krajewski at the Portland Art Museum. Rick, what's your role in Madison?
Senior curator. I've been there since 2006.
The show, which will probably go on tour nationally,
yes,
comes with a really big coffee table book called Andy Warhol Prints.
Yes.
And you're a contributor to that.
It's a rather splendid exhibition catalog, which has historical texts that Sarah Krajewski, the lead curator, wrote. But I was invited to do an extended essay on a single work. I chose the Flash Portfolio because it afforded me the opportunity to really get into the material and to talk about its various dimensions, particularly concerning what we might call the political Warhol.
This is a mega show at the Portland Art Museum. Jordan Schnitzer has been collecting Warhol for a long time. These are all prints, and this is the biggest print show of Andy Warhol ever.
Yes, indeed. I mean, it's quite remarkable for that. I mean, the scope and the depth and the coverage. When it was announced there'd be a show, there are many in the field who'd said, oh, another Warhol show? Because Warhol is up there with King Tut and Monet. However, it's not just another Warhol show. And those other Warhol shows were wonderful, but most of them focused upon the classic period of the 60s. What recommends this exhibition is not just the quantity, but also the fact that it's comprehensive. It covers his work from 1952 until his death.
So you're getting little cards he made to send to friends when
yes.
he was a sort of a graphic design student, and you're getting his late era endangered species
yes.
prints.
Yes. In fact, Sarah Krajewski, the lead curator for the exhibition, structured this retrospective exhibition.
The way it's laid out, you walk into the museum through the main entrance. You see a bunch of, what do you see, Chairman Mao's?
It's right off the bat, you're sort of taken aback because it's a rather splashy intro. A tall ceiling atrium where you come in and you're looking at one of Warhol's important motifs from the early 70s, Mao. He did a portfolio, Mao. He did many paintings, different sizes. He did wallpaper. And of course, the reason he turned to Mao in 70 because of Nixon's trip to China. Timely and topical, which you'll find out, Warhol always is. He's sort of right there in the moment. But you walk into the atrium and there are it's a two-story wall covered in Mao wallpaper with mm-hmm. the face of Mao from his little book. And you have what look like they're beanbag chairs, but they're huge and they're silver, which mimics the silver cloud helium pillows that were floated.
What are those beanbag chairs for? Can you sit on them?
Yes, you can sit on them. And they're extremely comfortable. The fear of the curatorial staff is that, and we saw this yesterday, people may fall asleep and not go into the show.
They're in a circle. Like, what are you supposed to do? Because you're looking away from the art.
Well, you can relax. And I mean, it's sort of a period posture, of course, to throw yourself into a beanbag chair in the 60s, let's say. But also, this is going to be a space where during the run of the exhibition, there'll be a series of guest printers who will do screen printing right there in the atrium.
Right.
Which is really quite wonderful. Mm-hmm. And then in this multimedia, immersive sort of installation opening to the exhibition, there's a large screen at the top of that wall, the back wall, which has a series of video images which in effect build up a Mao print color by color
mm-hmm.
from the first drop to the last drop of ink.
So he's doing a traditional screen print, and how many layers, how many colors?
It depends upon the print. I can give you the Warhol sandwich very quickly. Now this is the Ur Warhol print. You drop a background color, all turquoise, okay, and then you take another screen, which is a photosensitive stencil of a photographic image. Let's say that photograph of Mao on the cover of the little book. And then you squeegee black ink through the screen, and that photograph drops onto that background in black ink. And then, well, you can stop there if you want, but the sandwich I'm talking about, which sort of catches essentially all of the printmaking processes, is then you add other colors on top. And for Warhol, you know, at a certain point, he'll take a brush with paint and add to that too. So his work also, although you do the ABCs of his printing, which seems rather simple, Warhol is a great innovator in printmaking. I mean, just for the very simple fact that he took a silkscreen process, which was eminently an industrial commercial process, which, you know, you just look down your nose at if you thought it was going to be used for fine art.
What was it used for? Just T-shirts?
It's an early 20th century industrial application of imagery to cans and to crates for labels. And, you know, multiples, one after mm-hmm. another, after another, after another. But Warhol, and also in all fairness to a compatriot of his in art history, Robert Rauschenberg, both of them used the screen printing process in the early 60s. Rauschenberg did. He went in other directions, but at about the same time in 62, and in a sense they took printing, screen printing, which is another word for silk screening, because after a while it wasn't silk, it was synthetic fiber, and elevated it to a fine art. In fact, printmaking and the photographic image are at the very core of Warhol's work. One way of looking at it, which could put a smile on some faces, is that the paintings, they're screen printed paintings. So right there you have this confusion, you know, painting and printing. But silk screening it's always there. That's the core aesthetic technically of Warhol.
And this sort of room, you know, the atrium where you go in,
yes,
it collects, is it 10 Chairman Mao's together?
Yes, that is the Mao portfolio.
Right. So these have been broken up in the past and sold individually. And
they have been, yeah.
Jordan Schnitter's got 10 of them together.
Yes.
And what's the effect on the eye of looking from picture to picture? Is that, they were designed to be seen as a group?
It's designed, yeah, that's a very good question, because indeed, you know, Warhol, like other artists of the period, both abstract and representative, could work in series, and people spoke of seriality, where you take an image and you vary it. You vary it in color and form and shape, and so there plays upon each other. The theme, you might say, in the Mao's is that photographic image of Mao, and then the variations are from color to color to color. Your question, to see it as a whole, you see transformation, you see shift and change. You see what is a standardized image that is repeated over and over again on that cover of that book, and it takes on new dimensions, one from the other. I mean, it's wrenchingly, hysterically funny and deadly serious. Here's Mao, this dictator in the 20th century, and this is a fact. If you take all of his murders and deaths that he caused and executions, they swamp the competition, including Franco and Hitler. You know, we're talking millions of people. So you have this heinous murderer of the 20th century. And Warhol had a nickname for the series, Mao and Makeup. Mm-hmm. And so you have, and even sort of, I wouldn't call it blackface, but you know, like this stuff which colors his face, makes him a man of color, makes him lipstick like a woman. It's a kind of parody, but what makes it wrenching is knowing the backstory. Mm-hmm. But visually, it's just gorgeous. You know, that's one thing about Warhol as a graphic designer. He makes you want to buy the shoes by the way he advertises it. And when you see the Mao's all together, you're just like, just the color. I mean, if that's how some people get off, it's there to be gotten off of, because it's just so exquisitely beautiful. And think of that, exquisitely beautiful in Mao.
Mm-hmm. So then you go upstairs and there is his very early work when
yes.
he was a student or as a young graphic designer. So briefly,
yes.
he went to college and then he went to New York.
Yes.
And he became a great art designer.
Yes, he did.
Art director, sorry, in the commercial world.
Yes.
Before he was ever known as a fine artist.
Yes.
But early on, he was doing little prints of cards, you know, to send to friends. And you have
yes.
some of these are in the collection.
Right. And that first part of the exhibition, the chronology of which is 1952 until 60, the years during which he was, you know, the most famous graphic designer in New York. He did his commercial work, but he also did work that was self-published or work that he created, which was used by him as promotional materials, like a business card, except it was this wonderful design, like here's what I can do as a designer. And he did little artist books like A la Recherche de Chou Perdu, and he did the little artist book on pussycats.
Mm-hmm. What was that one called? 25 cats called Sam.
Yes, yeah. I know. And
one blue pussy.
And one blue pussy, yes.
What? That was a book design. Who was that designed for?
It was designed for friends, for him. I mean, in other words, it was Warhol working as an artist for a work of art that lightheartedly would be given, you know, to friends.
Mm-hmm.
I spoke to someone yesterday at the press conference who has a Slovakian background, and he said, and I you love this when you get, you know, there's always new information out there. He said, you know, what was so touching about that room is that if you're Slovak in any way, gift giving is extremely important. We Slovaks are always giving gifts to our friends. He said, and I said, boy, that puts a wonderful personal light, doesn't it, on what he was doing. These mm-hmm. these exquisite little drawings, offset lithographs, which were hand-colored with watercolor, with text that his mother, who had this wonderful eccentric cursive handwriting, would put on the page,
mm-hmm.
and also the hand coloring, the watercolors. He'd have parties where he'd have the offset prints, the outlines, okay, and then he'd sit around a circle with friends, and it would be like a hand coloring party.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so this community collaborative, this is, well, you know, the Warhol that you may not know. You may know the, you know, the public persona of the 60s, you know, distant, aloof, the dandy. He had so much heart, and I think that's something that this show does reveal, his humanity. And I mean, believe it or not, Andy Warhol can make works of art that will make you cry. Who thought it? Who would think of that?
There's a series in the same room of Jackie Kennedy, different shots of
yes.
Jackie before her husband was killed,
yes.
and then at the funeral.
Yes.
They're sort of smudgy, dark newspaper photos.
Yes, they are.
Taken.
Mm-hmm.
That seems like a very radical thing to do at the time. What was it done at the time?
To take...
That sort of public grief, these serious newspaper pictures, and blow them up and just alter them.
It was startling, because those photographs, for those of us who were there, but also, and I always love to get this in, even if you weren't there, even if you weren't there the day he was assassinated, her husband, it comes wrenchingly alive because of the way he presents it. I mean, you can cry if you were there, you can cry now, particularly with the flash portfolio, which mm-hmm. tracks the assassination. But no, that was, but by, back to your question, those images in was called 11 Pop Artists. It was a series of three portfolios. The shtick was each one, there was a small, medium, and large. And it was a pop art portfolio. And here is Warhol. You know, he's not doing a Rosenquist or a Lichtenstein, you know, sort of comical, satirical rendering of cartoons and billboards and advertising. He is putting one of the most incendiary images of the moment. I mean, because we saw the photo, first of all, those photographs, some you saw them, you saw the image as it was televised, some as you saw produced in black and white in Life magazine. And so it's not as though, if, like the first time, that was, by the way, my first print. I mean, I hate to be a little bit personal here, but my first print, and I bought it at Hudson's Department Store in 1967, was Jackie 2. It's from the second portfolio. And Jackie 2, the second portfolio, two Jackies. And it's Jackie looking almost like a Madonna in her black veil.
Mm-hmm.
Well, even then it was dynamite. But when you first saw that in the funeral, televised, but as a photograph, it was just I mean, you know, here's this Roman matron full of dignity who's just being so heroic, and you buckled over. No, I should keep on message with your question. No, it was very unusual. And then unusual to put in a pop art folio.
And it was 1963. He was doing it right away. It was like his response was immediate to make art.
Yes, he did. Both in 62, Monroe died. He immediately started doing his Monroe paintings. In 63, Kennedy was assassinated, but Warhol had already done in his glamour portraits, but they're hardly just that, of Liz Taylor, mm-hmm. of Jacqueline Kennedy. He started in 63 after the assassination to begin creating images from before the assassination, during the presidency, at the time of the assassination, and after the assassination. And those are all drawn from the media.
My name's Joseph Gallivan. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Rick Axum. He's the senior curator of the Madison Museum of Contemporary Art in Madison, Wisconsin. He's talking about Andy Warhol prints from the collection of Jordan D. Schnitzer and his family foundation, which is at the Portland Art Museum through January the 1st. I guess everyone will wander around the corner and see all the soup cans.
Yes.
And they, you know, they're so familiar. Why do you know why they have such prominence in that room?
Well, they're important. I'll tell you why, both aesthetically and historically. In 1962, Warhol was beginning to make his silkscreen paintings. He had been doing fine art. I mean, he'd moved in the late 50s to start trying to go uptown, so to speak, from commercial design to the august world, the elite world of art galleries and dealers and museums and curators to create paintings. Fine art, not connected to the commercial world. But New York had very little interest in it. One dealer in particular who thought Warhol's work looked too much like Roy Lichtenstein's. Warhol, as Warhol, the king of pop, was not born in New York. He was born in Los Angeles. In 1962, the Farris Gallery, run by Irving Bloom, put on an exhibition featuring Warhol's Campbell's soup cans, 32 canvases installed in a grid on the wall. And that was, I mean, there's so many instances historically in almost every area of culture where one thing does it, it's the overnight situation. It immediately catapulted Warhol. And within months, he had shows in New York. And the year 62 was when a group of curators and art writers and journalists met in this august panel discussion in New York to decide what pop art was. And that's when pop was born as a name. So there's Warhol in 62, right there at the beginning.
And then he went on and made these prints. So
yes.
Wasn't his thing, you know, he called his studio the factory.
Yes.
He was all about churning it out.
He had
no respect for the whole, you know, the scarcity of the object. He would make multiples, kind of like Dali. Why was he making these prints? What era are they, the ones you see in the museum?
When you come in, factory editions. He created this, his own company. Many people don't know the 1960s. He said, "I'm through with painting. Pooey, I'm not doing it anymore. I'm going to make films, and I want to make prints. I'm going to make prints to subsidize my films, and I'm going to make prints." I mean, I'm sounding like he was callous or cynical about this. He's a great business acumen, but the decision that he made, it's the results that we see, which we don't think, well, that was a good decision. It was, is that he. Warhol in the 66 and on in the 60s was an international celebrity. People knew him from those images like Monroe and the soup cans and of the flowers. And so he decided that he would make editions, limited editions of those images, not reproductions. We're talking about using that photographic image and refracting it through print media, different colors and compositions, so that people could have a piece of Warhol. You know, I was there then as a young guy in college, and there was talk of the American print renaissance and how democratic it was because, like me, a graduate student could drive from Ann Arbor to Detroit and buy an Andy Warhol. I could buy an Andy Warhol for $60. Mm-hmm. This is before the juggernaut. I mean, 4 years later, you know, it's something else. It's big business. So he was making prints to get the word out. And he was serious about this. And I don't think cynical. Other artists felt the same way. I mean, and it wasn't like a picture postcard or a secondhand piece of the artist's body of work, but it was authentic, and the artist owned it. So, but that is the, sort of the economic backstory, indeed, is why he turned to those particular, because the soup cans are 62, and here, you know, the portfolio is in the later 60s.
There's a dress in a glass case, paper dress of Campbell's soup cans. And that wasn't designed by him, right? This was the soup company. You could send in two labels and get
exactly.
a paper dress sent
and
back.
And it was called the Super Dress.
But was it anything to do with Warhol?
Yeah. I mean, he blessed it. Oh, absolutely. No,
okay.
No, it
was. So they were in on the joke kind of thing.
For sure.
Rebranding of themselves.
I know. It's amazing. We were talking earlier, and when was it? Was I an undergraduate or a graduate student? But Warhol came through Ann Arbor to our university bookstore to meet and greet. And my God, every undergraduate on campus. Now, this shows you a celebrity. These are students. I mean, that place was mobbed out into the streets, and Warhol was signing anything. He was signing. So to see all of these students rushing to every grocery store in Ann Arbor and buying a Campbell soup can and lining up holding it. And I remember.
What year was this?
This would have been like 64. And then I didn't see this because there were hundreds of students, and this may be proverbial, but. We heard, and it was in the paper, in the Michigan Daily, the student paper, that one young woman was just, she couldn't get a soup can. So what she did is she ripped open her blouse, and Warhol signed her, remember brassieres? Signed her brassiere. I mean, that's the notoriety and the celebrity and all the stir around Warhol. It was absolutely wonderful. The Daffy side of the 60s.
Uh-huh. There's a little section in the museum. It's erotic drawings.
Yes.
I think they're drawings in ink. Is that right? Are they
still screen? They're screen prints.
Okay. Was that a phase? Or why are they, apart from the fact that they're adult and they don't want kids going in there.
Right.
Was he doing this all the time?
You would associate the imagery with porn. Now, Warhol was gay, but of course closeted. We use language now that was never used in the day, believe me, like, you know, queer culture. But, I mean, the queer culture of the designers in New York in the 50s. But it was true. And of course, Warhol, Rauschenberg, and Johns, all gay. It was a closeted community. And that's why they were always in business suits within black ties, because you had to be palatable. And it was once suspected, but it wasn't really known. So there's that generation of gay men being secretive. And part of that feeds into Warhol's persona as, you know, my public face is this, I'm not saying anything, I'm detached, is to protect the vulnerable. It's like the turtle shell in presenting yourself. So with this, and it, no, there's no history of that kind of imagery, but, and it was, you'd almost think of it
but
as
that,
a kind
that wasn't
of private.
Public, right? He was doing this in private.
In private, although.
Or to give to people.
No, this was a portfolio that was published.
Oh, it was?
Yeah. But I mean, I never saw them at the time. I mean, I never saw them marketed. So it might indeed have been held back. He would Factory Editions would have published it, and you may be right. There might have been a limited audience for that. That was on the sly because it certainly never made the news. In fact, the first time I saw them, we're talking like the 80s, and I'm like, really, really? So it's an anomaly in one sense. In another sense, it's Warhol working through his sexual identity.
The downstairs, there is one giant room full of the most amazing sort of Technicolor prints, the endangered species,
species
the pandas
yes.
that everyone knows, a bunch of colored camouflage.
Yes.
Is this, I kind of think of Warhol as like the 80s Warhol, kind of
yes.
a bit burnt out, a bit of a aging kind of joke and kind of very paranoid and, you know, he did get shot. He had plenty to be paranoid about.
Yeah.
Is that a wrong image of him? Was he making all this vibrant work at that period in the 80s?
Oh, I think so. I mean, I think it. Right. I mean, he evolves and changes through his life experiences. But I mean, some of the most moving work. I mean, like there is the Black Gamma print from Ad Series, which is Judy Garland in a mink coat. Black Gamma was a campaign in the earlier 60s. when celebrities, the first two were Judy Garland and Betty Davis, and then a slew of celebrities, Lauren Bacall, who posed in black ranch mink coats. And the brilliant campaign, the caption for the campaign or the header was, "What becomes a legend most?" Okay? A mink coat and a beautiful woman, right? And Garland was asked to pose for it. And the backstory here is infinitely fascinating about that shoot. Richard Avedon was the photographer for the first phase of this campaign. Incredible photographs. And Warhol chose that, appropriated the image of the Judy Garland ad in the later portfolio ads. And I just ask any of you who do not know this, you will see it in the exhibition. It'll break your heart. I mean, if you see a woman, and what's great, which is not there, is to see what the ad looks like, and then to see what he does with it, because you'd never look at her ad. She never looked more beautiful. To say she looks so vulnerable and haunted, she has secrets that she can't tell. She's terrified. The print tells you that, and you see what Warhol does in it to make you respond to her as such. That's artful. I mean, that's a masterstroke of interpretation for him. And the Endangered Species portfolio, which numbers among one of my favorites, it speaks for itself. Warhol was asked by Ronald Feldman, who came up with the idea, would he be interested in doing a portfolio of endangered animals? And Warhol said, absolutely. And so the animals in this portfolio, some like the bald eagle, are no longer threatened, but the black rhinoceros is now extinct. There are still endangered species of concern. And so you have these 10. Now, I'll briefly tell you the conceit here, and I'll give you an Andy Warhol quote. I talked to you earlier about the black ink photographic image that's dropped onto the canvas or paper. It's always a positive of the photograph, okay? Get this, and I don't even have to explain. The image that Warhol, the photograph image that he dropped down onto the paper, and these are all photographs by a single photographer, was a negative image.
Of the animals?
Of the animals, yes. At this time, he's mostly using his own work, his own photography, but this was from a named photographer. And the photographic image, and I'll pause, it's rather dramatic, is a negative image. It's not positive. So it's the animal. And you take the negative as a metaphor for not being alive, and then he takes that negative image and makes it gloriously beautiful. That is the conceit. That's the conceit of a man who's on top of his game as an artist, and also reveals a side of Warhol which is surprising.
If it's a panda with a white head, is the head black in real life?
No, that's ink on top of the negative image.
That's white ink.
You'll see this particularly if you see the show. Look at the zebra. Of course, look at that for, the black and white zebra. And then it's a negative, so the whites are black and the blacks are white. And then he colors that. It's an extraordinarily beautiful print. But Warhol, you say, oh, that's Ron Feldman, his dealer. He came with that idea because it's very topical. No, Warhol very much responded because I spoke of his humanity, his sensitivity, his vulnerability, brooding, introspective. You see this in his self-portraits, his preoccupation with death. But he was also extraordinarily compassionate. Warhol, in the later 70s, early 80s, bought land at the east end of Long Island, Montauk, a fair amount of acreage, and where he would repair into the Hamptons, right here in Montauk, to relax and vacation. A few years later, he gave half of his acreage to a conservancy. See how that doesn't sort of fit the stereotypical view? He said, I just love this quote, "Having land and not ruining it is art of the most beautiful kind, which is worth having." This show shows that. And that's why it's a revelation.
My name is Joseph Gallivan. You've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week was Rick Axum. He is the senior curator of the Madison Museum of Contemporary Art in Madison, Wisconsin. And he was here talking about Andy Warhol, prints from the collection of Jordan D. Schnitzer and his family foundation. You can read more about it at the pam.org website or jordanschnitzer.org. Thanks very much for coming into KBOO.
Thank you, Joseph. Andy Warhol looks
said scream, hang him on my wall. Randy Warhol, silver screen, can't tell them apart at all.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 11:59. Coming up next is Buscando America.
Muy buenas tardes, esto es Tania Gómez Daza para KBOO News. A continuación, un corte informativo en español para el día 11 de octubre. Ayer se celebró el Día de la Raza o el Día para celebrar a la cultura indígena como una paradoja de la llegada de Cristóbal Colón a las Américas en 1492. En estas celebraciones, activistas indígenas en Fort Lewis College, en Durango, Colorado, pretenden presionar para que en las escuelas se enseñe la verdadera historia de las Américas, una historia a favor de los indígenas de este continente que ya habitaban estas tierras antes de la colonización europea, la explotación de los pueblos originarios, la trata de esclavos y el genocidio indígena. Crisis humanitaria en Haití tras el paso del huracán Matthew. El número de muertos ha ascendido a 1,000 durante este fin de semana debido a la infección por cólera. Este martes, la Organización Mundial para la Salud anunció el envío de 1,000,000 de vacunas contra esta enfermedad, que se trata de una consecuencia del consumo de agua contaminada. Haití es el país más pobre de América y este huracán tan devastador afectó el 80% de los cultivos, por lo que se espera que la gente abandone las zonas rurales hacia las zonas urbanas, empeorando aún más la situación. El domingo por la noche, Hillary Clinton y Donald Trump sostuvieron el segundo debate presidencial, donde se enfocaron a pelear y hablar sobre sexo, mentiras, videograbaciones y correos electrónicos, dejando de lado temas cruciales como el calentamiento climático, las guerras, la economía o la migración. A un poco menos de un mes de la elección general, la campaña republicana se encuentra en su peor crisis, mientras que Hillary Clinton apuesta a hundir más a Trump. Esto ha sido todo por el momento. Para más noticias nacionales e internacionales, escuche todos los días PM News en punto de las 5 de la tarde.